Yeah, so I grew up, my dad is very musical. Was in a band for a while, was a, you know, band, but I guess before that, you know, band director, choir director.
Still in Tennessee?
Fine. In Kentucky, is where I grew up. So just north, 3.5 hours north.
Okay.
And so I grew up around music. My mom, not musical at all. She's a journalist, so she's a writer. So I feel like I got a little bit of both of those worlds. But man, when I was a kid, I loved sports. You know, I was an athlete. And basketball and baseball. I was too short to play basketball, but I loved baseball. Baseball was like my game. And but when I was young, I was like 9. I just turned 10. And I started showing a liking to the drums. I always loved the drums, like when I'd go see my dad when he played. But I had never really thought about it. My parents noticed me banging on stuff, and I had a cousin that played the drums, and I would always want to play his drums and stuff like that. And
because is that drums like the worst possible instrument for parents, considering
totally.
Okay, they was big stuff. It can be expensive, noisy, you need to have it in the basement somewhere.
Completely. Yes. Yeah. So why it was such a surprise that year for Christmas my parents bought me a drum kit. I didn't ask for it. I didn't beg them for it. And it came out of nowhere, it surprised me. And I'll tell you, man, it was like, here we go.
Do you remember the brand?
Yeah, it was TKO Percussion. It was just a starter kit, $300, nothing, no big deal. Because they didn't know if I would, like, you know, really dig it. So they didn't, like, really go for, like, a nice one or anything. But, man, it sparked my love for it. And, you know, I was just about to go into middle school. And when I got into middle school, it was like the next year that I bought, you know, like a Pearl kit, you know, something that was a little bit nicer. And adding on to it big, you know, I wanted the big drums, I wanted cymbals, everything. And I kept playing baseball. Then right before I went to high school, I was like, you know what, I'm not doing sports anymore. I'm going to focus all my attention and all my time on music. And so, man, I was involved in everything music related in my town and outside of my town. I was doing symphonic band, I was doing jazz band, I was doing the school pep band, I was doing like a Central Kentucky jazz band, I was doing drumline, like everything. I wanted that to be so varied. And obviously I played in bands too. You know, I did it all. And I moved to Nashville in 2007 to go to school for music. And I met this guy. I met Tyler over there, 2009. And then we had a lot in common, like right off the bat. And had coffee one morning. And first time we jammed was a few months later, or a few weeks later. And man, I don't even know that we had a conversation about, like, hey, we're going to start a band. I think we just both assumed that we were in a band. You know, it was just like we had a jam and it was just full throttle, you know. We looked at each other after that first, he just looked at me and goes, let's play a groove. Let's just, you know, and then he looked at the bass player that I brought over, this that I had class with, and was like, jam and eat. We kind of looked at each other, I was like, counted it off, and afterwards it was awesome, and it was, we had immediate chemistry, and afterwards we kind of looked at each other and we were like, almost like kinetically, like, we're in a band, we just started a band.
So you're not born in Tennessee, but do you think one way or the other, the fact Nashville, famous city for more country music, but rock, one way or the other, do you think Nashville can shape one way or the other your musical identity?
Yeah, totally, because I think I matured so much more once I left home. You know, once I went, once I got to Nashville, I learned, you have to adapt, because it's so, I'm not going to say cutthroat, because it's not cutthroat, but everybody plays music there, you know, so you want to stand out and you want to be better than the rest. Now, it doesn't have that sort of atmosphere, it's not like competitive. It's maybe competitive, but it's still like friendly competitive, you know, like everybody cheers for one another, for the most part, at least everyone in our circle. So you want to be noticed, and you want to be good, and you want to be the best. And so definitely Nashville shaped that for me, you know.
Right. Growing up as a drummer, any inspiring model, I would say, like, favorite drummer?
Yeah, sure. I have several. I was just talking to him about that. Like I said, I grew up, like, kind of starting on jazz, and so I loved, like, Steve Gadd and Elvin Jones and Buddy Rich, you know, drummers like that. And then I kind of started really getting into, like, soul music, so I loved, like, and even, like, Steely Dan and stuff like that. And so I loved, which Steve Gadd played on some stuff, but I loved Clyde Stubblefield and, you know, even Stevie Wonder, you know, a great drummer, and Bernard Purdy, people like that. Mm-hmm. And then obviously when I got into rock, Bonham is a given. Keith Moon. I mean, even like Ringo kind of had a cool thing. Jeff Porcaro is a great one. Toto. He played on some great records.
It's a little bit on the side. You saw the movie Whiplash?
Yes.
From the drama point of view, is that an enjoyable movie or kind of...
Okay. I loved it.
Yeah, you enjoyed it?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, I clearly it was over the top, but it was entertaining for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
From a non-professional musician? Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I definitely was like, come on, like, this is a bit extreme, but I enjoyed it. You know what I mean? I thought the acting was good, and I don't know the conductor, I don't know his name in real life, but he's fantastic, you know?
Because you have the thing that sometimes in musical school you need mentors, but mentors can be positive or negative. Positive by, you know, trying to harvest your creativity and make you grow, or under pressure and push you too far, maybe, in the movie.
Sure.
So you still don't know, as a teacher, I would say, which...
I would never respond to that type of teaching. You know what I mean? That type of teaching, like I said, I mean, I think that movie is just far overboard. But I like the stern, like, kind of teaching, like, kind of hard love kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But that's, like, next level. You know what I mean? But I didn't enjoy the movie.
But I don't know, once again, from people outside the business, from a drummer point of view, you one way or the other, you kind of think that one way or the other, you might be, you know, focusing so much on tempo, or you're in the tempo. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, you that's the focus of all your creative or your way of playing. So how do you move from that, maybe with experience or practice?
Yeah,
move from that and enjoy without, like, it's not mathematics anymore. It's not science.
Sure. Sure. I think a lot of that, you know, happens as you start, like, you know, like, growing and playing and experience. I guess that's probably the best word for it. You know, it's that experience, but also learning how to kind of pull the reins in on all the things, adrenaline, all those things that kind of are a part of a show, and still being solid, you know. Tempo wise or whatever, it's like, you know, a greater conversation. But yeah, man, I'm, you know, I think all that plays a part.
If we come back to the second album, the self-titled ones in 2016, is there one souvenir, one event that in your mind synthesized this whole period around the album, from recording to tour to
whatever? Yeah, I think. I think what I would say, because we had just gotten off of that AC/DC tour in 2016, and this was 2017, we were like, we got to make a record. And I remember when we sat down to talk about the record, we all of our phones buzzed, and we got this text from our manager. Like, I'm not even lying, like, this was the second we sat down to talk about, all right, what songs are we going to do? Because we were doing this on our own. We had no label, you know, we were just going to self-fund it, and which basically meant we were going to do it for free and do it at Tyler's house with all of our gear and borrow stuff and just make it work. And we got a text from our manager, hey, you guys just got a bunch of Guns N' Roses dates. And it was like, yes, I mean, we had done some shows with Guns already, but this was like much more. We were going back to Europe. It was like, oh man, like, this is a moment. And I think that was kind of the moment where we were like, all right. And that helped shape kind of where we went from there, as far as like the songs that we chose, the songs that we wrote after that period, that whole kind of era. That year we went to South America. We did shows with Alice Cooper, The Who, Aerosmith, Guns.
But from the moment you heard the news, the tour itself was like 6 months ago, 6 months after, or?
No, I'd say it was probably three.
So your idea is that in the coming 3 months, that's the period we have to finalize the whole thing.
Yeah. So we were recording, we were writing, we were doing all this stuff.
And to get this deadline, you know, like in 3 months we'll be out. Is that an extra pressure or positive kick in the ass to?
Yes. Yeah. I think so. I think it's the latter. I think it pushed us to go. We have to make this the best that we can in within our circumstances. You know, we had no budget, we had no label, we had none of that, and so we did it on our own the best we knew how to. And I remember when we went to Europe and we played London. It was then when we kind of finalized the deal with Snake Farm. They came to us and, hey, we want to sign this record on, and then obviously from there we were able to finish it and actually have a budget to get it mixed properly and da da da. But you know, but man, we played some of the most memorable shows we've played on that run, and then after that too in South America, and that helped shape that whole period as far as like the record coming out and then what we did after and obviously where we are now. You know, all of that plays a part.
2 years between the release of the album, you think one way or the other it's the natural pace of the band?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it seems to be that way, right? I mean, 2013, 15, even though 15 was an EP, which should have been a full record, we did 13 songs and only put out 6, which is a whole other story. But yeah, 13, 15, 17, 19 now. Seems like a pace. Now, if it was up to us, we'd put out records far more frequently, but you know, I guess we're at about, yeah, it's about a year and a half, maybe a little more, because the record came out in November, so, but yeah, man, I mean, I think it seems about right.
Because I read that for this record, you had to choose between 55.
Yeah, there's a bunch of songs, man, and I don't know that we think about it too much. I think, like, after a record comes out, it's like already a new album cycle. You know what I mean? We're already writing for the new album. So a lot of songs kind of happen, and like I said, we don't really go, hey, we're writing for a new album. We just write to get to create, just to create and to get that artistry out.
But when you say we have potentially 55 songs, how far did you go in the finalizing of these 55 songs? It's ideas, basic.
No, it's or finished in those.
And so for this record, the idea was, you have to choose between the
songs. Sure, yeah, absolutely. And so we created this Dropbox link, passed the songs around within our team, and then obviously the four of us internally sat down and discussed. Basically, we cut them in half. We were like, and honestly, it was a little bit easier than I think it may seem, because they were definitely like, okay, we like this song, but it's not a Shakedown song. You know what I mean? Like, because we don't always write for our band. We just write to have songs. And, okay, cool, we throw that out. This, I'm not a fan. 2 out of 4, don't like it, out. You know what I mean? So we kind of started to whittle it down and got to about 27. And that's what we agreed. We made a new list of those 27, sent it to Joel, who produced the record, and we started learning the songs individually. And then we sat down in Tyler's basement, kind of where we rehearse and where we record, where we did the self-titled record. And I used to live there with him as well, you know, back when. But and played through them. Played through all the songs. And then from there, started to whittle down even more. Okay, which ones don't feel great, like, with the four of us playing them?
Because some songs can be good, but it's not, you don't have the global chemistry.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's what I mean. And so it's like, all right, I dig this, but it just doesn't feel right when we play it. And I think it was evident, you know, for certain ones. And we tried and we tried and we tried and we tried to do this and that. And, you know, we tossed them out. And maybe if there were some that, like, we weren't really feeling or digging, which there were a couple I could name, several off the record that we hadn't quite pinpointed the vibe or maybe the... There's a few things. But Joel, like, heard something in it, we would just kind of set it aside. And songs like Couldn't See the Fire and Without You are the two I'm thinking about. Those really were shaped in Brooklyn, in the studio. But there were definitely, like, I'd say 7 or 8 that were like, oh man, like these are songs that were gelling on, that feel great, that across the board everyone was liking. So it was overwhelming as many songs, but as we started to kind of narrow it down, we started to have more of a clear vision of like, okay, this is the record that we need to make. And then we started to find the holes of what we were missing, and we're like, okay, cool, we need a like a barn burner song. And that's where like Drive Me Mad came in, and you create this kind of, you know, trajectory, I guess.
So from 55, 27, from 27.
I'd say 27. I'd say we probably went up to Brooklyn with, I'd say 16, 17, 18 maybe, and then we tracked 14, and then finished 13.
There's no Japanese bonus or.
No, we didn't even finish that 14. The truth is that we were only supposed to do 11. That was what we were supposed to do. And so we were like, well, let's just do extra songs and we can have bonus tracks. But then we finished those 13. The 14th was like an outlier. We did it, and after we were done, we were like, I don't think we're going to finish that. It just didn't feel like it fit. So we kind of threw it out pretty quickly. But the other 13, we were like, all right, well, we're probably going to have 2 that we, you know, have as B-sides or whatever. But then when we finished them all, we were like, we can't imagine this album without, you know, like this song or this song. Like, it's going to be hard to do that. And so we had to talk our team into it, but we ultimately did, and we're like, we're putting them all out.
So all the songs that was brought on the side, put on the side, it's dead forever, or you keep them?
No, I think
it might come back one way or the other.
I think so. Yeah, a lot of people have asked that. It's like, you know, it's like a song like out there. I mean, that was written 7 years ago, and we've tried to fit it in on albums, and it just, you know, hasn't worked. And so there's definitely songs that I could think of off the top of my head that were in that original 55 song batch that I still love and that I still think will find a home at some point on a Shakedown record. I just don't think that they made sense for, you know, this record.
So for Truth and Lies, you worked with Joel Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
My question might sound naive or even kind of stupid, but what's, from your point of view as a musician, what's the added value of such a producer like him?
Yeah, I think a added value for any producer is having a fresh perspective, having someone come in to kind of pull you out of kind of your normal. I think with a band...
Normal or comfort zone?
Yeah, comfort zone. Yeah, the same thing. Like, what we are good at sometimes, or, you know, kind of like what we do, sometimes it's nice to bring someone else in and go, help us refine what this is. Help us go... And honestly, I think the best way I can say it is Joel helped us get out of our own way. I think sometimes we are so zoomed in to what we're doing and to the project and to the writing and to the recording and to all the stuff, and we're perfectionists and we're control freaks and all these things that kind of come along with that, and you kind of have this tunnel vision of like as far as like how far you can see. And I think that Joel like widened that perspective to go like, oh, like, oh, you try this and it helped us, like, you know, encouraged us to take risks and so it was nice to have almost like a fifth band member to kind of come in and to shake things up a bit.
And does it work differently or have a different influence compared, for example, a guy like Vince Powell who works on...
Oh yeah, sure. They all work differently, and that's why it's tough to kind of nail one person down for projects. I mean, you're going to get this here and this here and this there. But that's the beautiful thing about music too, right? And people that work in the industry, because, you know, we could have made the same record with the same songs with someone else and it would be a totally different album. I don't know. I think the other thing with Joel that we were really keen on was it being out of Nashville. We didn't want to make a record at home. We didn't want to... I love working with Vance. Love working with Vance. Vance is amazing.
And especially in New York, was it kind of a kind of a goal to go there? I mean, the city.
I mean, I think so. I don't know that we were like dying to go to New York, but I think that we were dying to get out of kind of what was, like you said, comfort zone. Like, we were dying to get out of, like, what we knew. We wanted to, like, not be in Nashville. We wanted to get away from, like, our everyday life. We didn't want distractions. We wanted to be fully immersed in
no distractions in New York.
Well, I mean, the thing is, like, we were in the studio every day, all day.
No, but if Joel was not living in a studio in the middle of, I don't know, Vermont, would be the same for you? Different. Or New York has this kind of special.
I do agree. I mean, it's a good point. Because I think the city is kind of brings different life into the songs, and you're kind of inspired in a new way. And I loved like taking the subway every morning to the studio. And
yeah, you don't go, you go out in the evening, have a drink somewhere.
I sure. Think.
It's a New York.
It's just vibe. It's a different vibe. Yeah. And we talked about it in a previous interview, like. You know, maybe those like kind of gloomy moments on the record, like it was freezing there, like freezing. It was in January, February, so it's like the first day we got there was 0 degrees, and so it was just cold. And but like I don't know, I still loved it in this like weird way. I hate cold weather, I hate it, but I love New York. Like I love New York. Tyler doesn't as much. He's not a big fan, but I think that he came out of that experience going like, oh, you know what, it's not so bad.
From Texas, makes sense?
Totally, right? Totally, like overwhelming and like just too much going on. But we were obviously in Brooklyn, Williamsburg, so it's like different. Like I only went to the city once to see a show with our agent. And it was cool, but like we were in the studio like literally the whole time, you know? It was every day, all day. And that was cool, man, you know, to have that like everybody all in, just fully just diving in. I think was cool and important for the final product.
In your mind, how important is the cover picture, and how did you work the cover picture?
Yeah, so we found the picture. We found this artist, Mrs. White, out of Germany, and we loved her work. It's very weird.
But you browsed internet. And
yeah. Actually, one of our managers like had found some artists, and she was included, and we were kind of just stumbling through her stuff, and it's just very abstract and different, and we just were really drawn to it. And we were looking through it, kind of finding maybe some options. And that was one that stood out for some reason.
Because the image existed before, or you...
The image existed before, but we basically bought license rights from her in order for us to manipulate and to kind of, you know... So we didn't change a lot, but we definitely textured it, you know, added some little treasures that, like, are, you know, that you have to, like, really pay attention to notice. And obviously the name and the title and stuff, but I don't know, man. There's just something about that. Like it tied in a lot with the lyrics. Like you know, it's funny when you like listen to the record and look at the album cover. I feel like you notice a lot of things about why we chose it. Songs like Eye to Eye, Couldn't See the Fire, Panic Button, Blinded, But I Gotta See Clear. You know, in Truth and Lies, man, it's like in our world today, it's so difficult to tell what is what, what's true, what's not. No,
but it wasn't the cover picture that changed the lyrics. Yeah. You just found that the lyrics were there. This image fits in the your world.
Yeah, because we didn't choose the image until after the album was done. And we felt like it was a great representation of, and we didn't want a picture of the band. We wanted to do something different. We wanted something that like was thought provoking for people. And so it's a little bit different. Like, and we had to convince our team. Trust me, like they weren't massive fans of it at first. But I don't know. I was really into, you know, you've got this man and a girl and. Maybe it's love, maybe it's like, what is it? Like, people can interpret it a lot of different ways. But the thing is you have the radio in the middle, and the music lives in the middle. And the music is what grounds us. And whether it's a truth, or whether it's a lie, or whether it's whatever, all this in the pandemonium of where we live, the music is still what lies in between and what ties us all in. So that's kind of like where the image kind of came into play.
It's still individual, so you use this universe and this... different characters in the video clips, or Shock and
yeah.
In general, shooting videos, do you like that kind of exercise, or it's kind of a necessary pain?
I would say both. I think sometimes it's overwhelming and it's but man, sometimes if it's done right, I had such a blast doing that one. I loved that one. I love that it's different and weird and it makes people think. And but sometimes I don't love it. I've had a blast doing these last two for Tyler did a great job on Onto the Next. He's the one that kind of put that one together. And obviously we all like did some playing and stuff, but he edited it and stuff like that. But I don't know, man. I love that, the shotgun. I love shooting it. I'm a snake guy, and that's the reason that there's snakes in it. I was like, man, the shotgun like doesn't, you know, it makes me just think of, like, I don't see snakes slithering around. And so,
Are new videos in the pipes for coming, or?
We're planning on doing a video for Ride. That's basically after we get home from this. That's kind of what's coming up next.
One of my last questions. So as you mentioned, you tour with huge bands, AC/DC, Sleep Eating, ZZ Top, Guns N' Roses. Being around that kind of guys with a long experience to see how they work, how they prepare, their healthy life or not healthy life.
Sure.
One way or the other, could you grab experience from those guys?
A 1,000%. Like, we've learned so much from all those experiences, and I think it's shaped. I don't think I know. It's shaped our songwriting. It's shaped how we tour. It's shaped how we put together a show. How we put together a set list. How we put together pre-show music. You know what I mean? Like to the detail. You learn so much in those scenarios, and we've been able to kind of rub shoulders with those people, and they've given us sound advice, and everybody's just been so encouraging.
Without any names or any kind of scoop or whatever, when you met these guys and saw how they prepare and the ABA, were there huge surprises for you? Because sometimes you have the cliché, you know, it's at the end of the show, it's, I don't know, drugs, booze, and whatever, sex. Whereas most of the time it's very hard to life because they have to manage your 30 shows in a row. And so if you play it like that, you're dead after a week.
Yeah, I feel like that stigma is dead. You know what I mean? I feel like that sex, drugs, rock and roll, sure, it like still exists with some people, but man, like when you're on that level, at that age, you can't do it anymore, you know? And maybe it was a thing at one time, but like, I just think that the day is over. But man, you know, it's... So I think we were surprised, maybe to a degree, on just how welcoming a lot of people were, you know? Because, and supportive, you know, just the fact that they had us out there and invited us to their dressing rooms and told us, like, how much they like our band and how much they've enjoyed having us on tour. And I think those things are, you know, like, keep doing what you're doing because you're doing it the right way. You're doing it like how we did it. And I think that was pretty cool for us to hear and encouraging at the same time, you know.
Yeah, it's not American Idol. I mean, you all follow the hard way from scratch, building up slowly, and reaching or have album after album in the audience.
And it's growing, and even if it's slow, it's still like expanding a bit. You know, and I just think stuff like that creates longevity. I think when you build a career like that, grassroots, kind of cult almost. Those people are always going to be around, you know, rather than like overnight success that kind of maybe lasts for a year and then it's gone. I think as we build, as we grow, that's what creates a career, or at least that's what I like to think, you know, and that's what we're obviously going for.
All right. Thank you very much.
Cheers, brother. Appreciate you, man. Thanks so much.